listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.
And good evening, and welcome to History and You, the show where history matters because you decide what history becomes. I'm your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts and insights, please call at 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Call in and tell me your view on the issue tonight. If, on the other hand, you're shy about going on the air but want to contribute anyways, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll find me at the latalkradio.com website. That's latalkradio.com under History and You. Also, please visit and support my Facebook and Twitter links on the website as a follow-up to each program. Tonight's topic is fashion or provocation. That's fashion or provocation. Do we dress for fashion to be in vogue, or do we dress to provoke? It's a topic that suggests a revisitation of how we choose to express ourselves in the way we dress for an evening social or just going to work. And, you know, I have to ask myself a lot of questions about this regarding fashion or provocation. A lot of questions as far as what we do, why we do it, how we do it. In what direction are we taking ourselves in relation to how we dress? These are all questions that I ask, that I want to share these questions with you, because it is something to think about. It is something to contemplate. It is something to begin to develop some degree of conviction about. How do we look when we go outside? And so I ask myself a lot of questions about this. What message do we send out to others when choosing to dress a certain way, and how often is our manner of dress misinterpreted by even our closest friends and associates? A misinterpretation that your friends will never tell you about. And that's the interesting part about it. Your friends make judgments, and they'll never let you know about it. Fashion and all behaviors that go along with it is for everyone to do and for everyone to enjoy. But how well we wear and walk the fashion of the day without looking risque, inadequate, or even desperate is very important for us. How well we wear and walk the fashion. And sometimes we don't always do it well. So, how should we wear our personalities without screaming or boasting about it? What kind of colors do we wear? How many colors do we avoid? And why? I mean, these are things that a lot of people look at and they say, wow, look at this guy. Or look at this woman. How tight or how loose should we wear our clothes before somebody does something about it? What is it that you do that enables you to have self-respect? In a similar way, what takes away from a person's self-respect in relation to what you do or don't do? And this, of course, goes back to how we dress. A lot of people would like to argue that image is everything. There was a commercial long ago that said that you never get a second chance at making a first impression. And to some degree, I would even argue to a large degree, it's true. Image, I don't think, is everything, but it's a lot. It's certainly enough for people to think either very poorly of you or very well about you, even before you speak out a word. It's that delicate. Let me talk to you a little bit, let me give you a little bit of background on the history of American fashion. As a simple point of reference for you to begin to contemplate the degree to which fashion has evolved into even psychological issues, criminal concerns, and multiple lawsuits. Lawsuits for American society to absorb. The clothes we wear and the trends we follow are often associated with superficiality and materialism. And unfortunately, it takes away from the substance of our character sometimes, or like Martin Luther King once said, the content of our character. And this is true, unfortunately, but it does often associate with superficiality and materialism. Fleeting styles come rapidly into vogue, and then they disappear just as quickly as they came. But fashion has always been intrinsically connected to deeper elements of the American experience. From the economy and labor system to culture, religion, class, it cuts across all of that. Even from our underwear to our Levi to our sneakers, what we wear has, and for centuries, spoken volumes about who we are and what we do, and certainly what we want. Whether Americans have dressed to make a political statement, to assert their class status, or simply to be irreverent, every style has carried a certain social meaning. And I think this is in part because our culture has long ascribed great significance to individuals' public image, and because image has long been intertwined with the American capitalist economy. You know, as Mark Twain once wrote, clothes make the man. Naked people have little or no influence on society. Well, then again, Twain never lived to see the rise of Playboy. Clothes, or the lack thereof, remain central to contemporary American culture and integral to our national history. Now, whether you've argued with your parents or friends about what you wear, or even cringed as you gazed at old pictures of yourself in a once trendy style, or judged another person by his or her choice of clothes, you know that fashion matters in our day-to-day lives. Terms like white collar and blue collar only show not just a line of work, but a person's class status. And it reminds us that we tend to make assumptions about a person's income, about a person's line of work, about a person's social position based on the way he or she dresses. Fashion history also extends beyond the economics of designer profits and class systems. Issues of gender, power, sexuality all intersect with the clothes we wear. As incredible as that sounds to you, it is true. Many people judge a woman's sexuality and values by the way she dresses. If her clothes are deemed too revealing or flashy, she might be called a hoe. Regardless of how exaggerated or contrived these presumptions might be, they continue to pervade our popular culture. Let me take a quick moment to pause to remind our audience, for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Okay. Let's consider the case now of a dentist in Iowa named Dr. James Knight and his assistant, Melissa Nelson, who was fired after 10 years of service for looking too attractive. Yeah, that's right. That's what I said. For looking too attractive. For looking too irresistible. Perhaps looking too provocative for the good doctor to handle with grace while on the job. And this is the reason why I titled this show this evening as Fashion or Provocation. Because, folks, this is a real case that took place, that is taking place. Is this a case of discrimination, specifically gender discrimination? Well, that's what Melissa Nelson thought, but not the Iowa State Supreme Court. By a unanimous vote of 7-0, the High Court of Iowa ruled that there was no discrimination. And the dentist, Dr. Knight, had every right to fire her because there was no violation of sexual harassment anywhere in the Iowa Civil Rights Act. Since this case dealt with a woman's choice, in this case, according to this particular case, since it involved a woman's choice of how to dress, according to the man, Dr. Knight, and not a man's choice, the question thus becomes one of degree or extent. In much the same manner as if it were a man, since you also have to question the amount of time it took for James Knight to react the way he did after 10 years of working with her. So I begin to ask questions again, as far as how in the world did this woman even get to file a lawsuit, and how this whole situation became a lawsuit and went up on appeals to the Iowa State Supreme Court. It's incredible how these kinds of issues just have a way of coming to the public eye, and people begin to wonder and they begin to ask questions, such as the questions that I want to ask now, such as the questions that I need to share with all of you now. If only out of moral concern. So, for example, and again, I stress, this was a woman's choice, according to Dr. Knight and the Iowa State Supreme Court. How tight must a woman's dress, pants, shorts, or bathing suits be before someone else, be it another woman or another man, triggers a response of morality? How tight? How tight must it be? How in the world do you measure that? I don't know. Another question that I have. How much of a low-cut dress does it have to be in order for a woman to look elegant and classy, and not slutty and whorish? Another question. What does it cost and what does it take to have good taste? This is probably one of the hardest things to answer. What does it cost, and especially what does it take for someone to act and to look with good taste? Oftentimes, people say that self-restraint is the better part of manners. Does this begin to answer this last question? I don't know. Another question that comes to mind. How high the hem before sex enters a man's mind? How high should the heels of a woman's shoe be before they become stilts or a for sale sign for legs on discount? What has happened to the element of mystery in a woman? Because this is what created a curiosity, a heuristic, a reason to pursue, a reason to follow up, a reason to be romantic, a reason to want to know more, to bait the fish along. Oh, no, 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 no. What's happened to the element? Has it been redefined? Has it redefined itself? Has it become something obsolete? Or is it just dormant? Or has it just disappeared altogether? I don't know, but all you have to do is go out there and take a look. Take a look at, and to be fair, take a look at the way men dress and how suggestive their manner of dress is, and how do women dress? Has the art of providing an elegant curiosity without disclosing a story been traded off for a misleading adventure of show more and get more? Go ahead. Call me and tell me your view. Tell me where you stand. And now for the good doctor. Dr. James Knight, the man who decided to fire this young woman for what he thought was something that distracted his view. Did not enable him to focus or concentrate on his dental work. If he was pulling out a molar, he might have been looking elsewhere. If he was looking at a receding gum line, he was looking elsewhere. Well, why didn't he keep his mind on his work? How tight did that dress have to be for him to react the way he did after 10 years? After 10 years. Actually, I read the case. I read the 16-page Iowa State Supreme Court case, and it was closer to 11 years. So I should really say 11 years. Okay? So now for the doctor. I have to ask myself, how weak in character did he have to be to work in that office in silent perversion of Melissa Nelson for 10 years until his wife, his own wife, decided to put an end to it by having him fire her? Oh, you didn't know that, did you? I'll say that again. He decided to fire Melissa Nelson after working with her for 10 years until his wife, his own wife, decided to put an end to it by having him fire her. I also have to ask myself, how long did this hypocrisy have to run before Melissa Nelson paid the price of Dr. Knight's mental condition, the price of his mental sexual arousal? Did the doctor have sexual issues with his wife, which made him look elsewhere every time he had a patient open his mouth? Only to find things in Melissa Nelson that were never there? Maybe he was indeed very, very inadequate. How many other sick men are still out there, waiting like predators, ready to hunt on another girl's innocence and sink his bite into her for the fun of his fantasy? Could his mental condition even lead to future crimes? Could criminal behavior be teased out of this? Could there be a buildup of sexual frustration or social frustration or peer frustration? Whatever kind of frustration, could criminal behavior become an outgrowth of this? Or could it be largely contained through therapy? No. Let me take another quick pause here to remind our audience, in case you're just joining us late, for the participants who wish to call with questions or comments, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. So now let's discuss what the High Court in Iowa decided to do. The Iowa State Supreme Court decided unanimously, which says a lot, that there was no discrimination found in the Nelson case. So let's take a closer look at exactly what constitutes the magic word, discrimination. Because Melissa Nelson did file for discrimination. She felt that she was unfairly classified, which is part of the definition. She was unfairly classified in a way that did not justify her dignity at all. So let's see what constitutes discrimination. Let's begin with the question, is it reasonable to discriminate when it is reasonable to be the object of discrimination? Let me ask that again. Is it reasonable to discriminate when it is reasonable to be the object of discrimination? In other words, what I'm asking here is, was Melissa Nelson's tight work clothes enough of a provocation for Dr. Knight to discriminate against Nelson? Was it enough of a provocation? To discriminate means to distinguish or to treat or to differentiate one thing from another, from one person to another. Legally, discrimination means, as interpreted and understood by general consensus of the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment, an intentional categorization of things or people by the government for creating a justifiable exception due to extraordinary circumstances. It is an intentional categorization or classification of things or people by the government for creating an excusable exception due to extraordinary circumstances that are currently being suffered by people. So, for example, are there legal kinds of discrimination? Yeah, there are. What kinds? Well, not letting legally blind people drive. Because if you allow for that, you are posing a huge public danger out in the street. From hitting other cars to hitting other properties of people, be it business properties or people walking on the sidewalk, to hitting other cars, to running into a post, a lamppost, whatever. You're posing out there automatically a public danger. So allowing people to drive is an excusable classification, a justifiable categorization to set these people aside and allow for a fair discrimination. Because you cannot allow legally blind people to drive. You are posing for other people, as well as the legally blind person, obviously, an unnecessary and an unreasonable danger. Another example is allowing for special constructed ramps or closer parking spaces for the handicapped. Well, obviously. Common sense, many times, is the most uncommonly thing found. Of course you have to make exceptions for these people. You're really not going to expect these people to park God knows how far away from their intended destination, be it a store or anything else, and have them wheel themselves through passing traffic just to get to the open door of the store that they're going to. Clearly unreasonable. Okay? So the law has to have a good public purpose. Another example is making people wear a shirt in certain public places. Sometimes you have to even wear a coat and tie out of a sense of public decency. You're not going to go to a soiree or some kind of an other evening's function, a very, very classy restaurant, without a shirt. Walk in there and say, well, this is my individual right to do so. No, it's not. No, it's not. And you have to get out. So, there are kinds of justifiable discriminations. There are three basic conditions that determine whether an action of discrimination is legal. First of all, you have to classify a specific group. You got to target a race group or a nationality, Mexicans, Asians, Latins, whatever they be. You got to target gender or sexual preference, gays, or many other groups that are still out there. You got to target or classify a specific group. This is the first condition to determine whether an action or a law of discrimination is legal. Number two, you got to put out a law. The government has to put out a law or an action on the part of an authority has to take place. And this law or action on the part of an authority has to have a good public purpose behind it. The law has to have a certain degree of public purpose. The public purpose to classify handicaps is to make them get off their vehicle and walk to their destination easier and safer. So the law in bringing them to the forefront has a public purpose. And number three, that law or action has to make a relationship with something called the rational basis test. In other words, the rational basis test means that the law or action, after classifying this group, has a well-intentioned or a sound rationale to provide a good public purpose. So then, when is discrimination illegal? It becomes illegal when a law or an action has unreasonably, and let me repeat, unreasonably, or even arbitrarily, classified a group without a good public purpose in mind, to serve them or to help them in some way, like with the handicap, for example. And as a consequence, it has created a relation with something called the suspect classification test. This test, suspect classification, also has three conditions that can determine the illegality of a discriminatory action. It has to have historically suffered a disability. In other words, this group that is targeted must show a track record of having historically suffered a continuous disability. For example, blacks have a long history of having suffered a disability of some kind, of being deprived of some kind in some way, continuously. The second condition, this group must have suffered unequal treatment. And the third condition, this group must have had or held a social position of being politically powerless. So, the group targeted has to have shown a long track record of historically suffered disability. This group has to show that they have been treated unequally. And third, this group must have had, for a long period of time, a social position of being politically powerless. Therefore, because of these three conditions, the government requires that this group that has been unfairly targeted, requires special judicial protection. And who has been entitled to receive this special judicial protection? Race groups, ethnicities, gender groups, and of course, sexual preference groups. This only applies to actions or laws that have unfairly classified or targeted a group. So let's connect this now to the case of Dr. Knight. In the Nelson case, James Knight complained that her clothes were too revealing and too distracting. However, she claimed she wore scrubs to work. Okay. They also exchanged text messages together about insignificant things, and being married with children, Nelson also claimed she never flirted with him. Never flirted with him. Interesting. It wasn't until Dr. Knight's wife discovered their text messages that she persuaded him to fire Nelson. And because Dr. Knight fired Nelson to avoid any sexual harassment in the workplace, and because it was also a way to save his marriage and his family, the Iowa State Supreme Court decided that Nelson's termination did not constitute any gender discrimination. Let me repeat this again. The Iowa State Supreme Court decided that Nelson's termination did not constitute any gender discrimination. In other words, what the Iowa State Supreme Court is telling us is that Dr. Knight's action of firing Melissa Nelson did not show in any way a historically suffered disability on the part of Melissa Nelson looking too attractive. It did not show in any way an excessive amount of attractiveness as having a long track record of unequal treatment. And it did not show in any way that being too attractive also shows to be politically powerless, which requires special judicial protection. Now, whether the Iowa State Supreme Court got it right or wrong is not so much the issue, but rather that this is the way the high court in Iowa interpreted this situation. And it's even more interesting how this court ruled 7-0, that bosses can fire employees they see as an irresistible attraction, even if the employees have not engaged in flirtatious behavior or done anything wrong. Nelson's firing may seem unfair, but it wasn't unlawful to warrant or justify or constitute discrimination of any kind, because these kinds of bosses, as Justice Edward Mansfield of the Iowa State Supreme Court said, and I quote, "These bosses are motivated by feelings and emotions, not gender." So it was because of feelings and emotions that Dr. Knight had, which did not historically show any suffered disability, did not show unequal treatment, and did not show a history of political powerlessness. In the view of the court, Knight fired Nelson in the interest of saving his marriage. Not because she was a woman. He fired Nelson in the interest of saving his family, his marriage, his wife, his friends, his position, his job, his career, everything. And not because she was a woman. It had nothing to do with being a woman. Tell me whether you think the Iowa State Supreme Court got it right or got it wrong. Send me an email, historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. Or give me a call. Okay. Is this case a victory for family values in America? Is this a victory? Well, now we've come to the final part of our show, where I wish to leave you with a final thought to consider, a final thought to further reflect regarding the signs of our time. Some final thoughts. From 1940 up through the 1950s, and I say from 1940 because the 1920s was pretty much of a rambunctious decade. And the 1930s was a decade of tremendous adversity and tremendous personal suffering because of the effects of the Great Depression. But from 1940, America seemed to have settled down to some degree. America seemed to have a new focus. World War II was clearly wrong. Hitler was clearly wrong in what he was doing and or not doing, however you wish to perceive the situation. We had a clear sense of purpose. Hollywood was doing well. Our boys were fighting abroad for all the right reasons. We were beginning to climb out of the Great Depression, and life was beginning to taste a little better. In the 1950s, after the war, America was clearly enjoying economically, socially, well-integrated, politically, well-identified. Even in relation to the Cold War, the world was bipolar, and each camp knew its agenda, understood the idea of what it took to maintain and keep the integrity of national security. Even throughout the Cold War years, America had a sense of purpose and focus. The world knew, and America, through its own propaganda, began to propagate the idea that Soviet motives and intentions were clearly wrong, and American democracy was clearly right. It was the right way to pursue and to persevere and to move forward and make progress in the name of America. So the 1950s was even better identified. So from 1940 up through the 1950s, the chances were better than average that Melissa Nelson wouldn't have been fired. She wouldn't have been fired because women at the time understood better what it meant to be a lady or ladies. And men, more often than not, in the public eye, were more of the gentleman sort in thought, in spirit, and in body and mind. Today, the public image of who we are has been so experimented and so often stood on its head that we as people seem to have lost much of our traditional standards. And while many would applaud this feeling of being unconcerned about expressing our individuality through the way we dress, others remain constrained, confused, very confused, and contrived about living their lives without some standards of public decency that once predominated more of the American consideration for fashion. Fashion is a public responsibility to you and to others. Fashion is a public responsibility for everyone. And whether you wish to accept this or not, dressing a la mode can sometimes carry consequences. The cost of feeling so carefree as to never having to feel the need to step back and see what you look like, as well as to see what others will be looking at before you walk out the door, can come at too high a price. Morality, for whatever you may consider it to be, however you may decide to agree or disagree with, morality matters, I'm afraid. It always will, because it always has. Morality, you may consider it to be an ingredient that determines, an ingredient, a component, a pillar that drives and determines the extent to which our civilization as a free people will be maintained, will be uncompromised, will be or will remain impervious, as much as human imperfection will allow that to happen. We all have to follow a moral matrix to guide our lives, whether you agree with it or not. It's there. It will always be there. And depending on the examples that we as adults provide our children, that will determine the inspiration you reap from the efforts in your life. So before you step out the door, look at yourself and ask, what do you stand for? What do you stand for? Don't forget to catch me again next Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, that is, by visiting our website at latalkradio.com. That's latalkradio.com, and look for History in You. And also, please remember to visit and support my Facebook and Twitter links on the website as a follow-up to each program. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling, wishing all of you a very pleasant evening. A very pleasant evening. Good night.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling, right here on LA Talk Radio.